This is number 0091, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0091. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Carla Malden, who is the daughter of Academy Award-winning actor Carl Malden. She's also a young widow and has written about that experience in After Image, a broken-hearted memoir of a charmed life. Was it cathartic to write this book?
I would say that for me personally, the experience of grief was very fracturing. By that I mean it was kind of a schizophrenic experience, like patting your stomach and rubbing your head at the same time. I would be out to lunch with a friend, but I was really in the business of grieving. Or I would be at the movies, but I was really in the business of grieving, always sort of detached from the moment. And when I sat down to write, I was all in one place. Body, mind, and heart.
Angela Crocker is the author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Creating a Social Network. Why would someone even need their own social network?
If you have a social network on your own website, you own that little piece of real estate on the internet, and as a result, you have control over it. That its fate is in your hands. It can continue to exist as long as you think it needs to exist. If you rely exclusively on something like Facebook, you never know what's the latest change. What is Facebook going to shift to a new format? Are you going to be able to contact your people?
And we'll hear from Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, who shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance line. He has opinions on everything, including his own taxi business.
A cab is to take you from point A to point B in about 12 minutes. You don't need any amenities. And above all, as I instruct all the drivers, just keep your mouth shut and drive.
Plus, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0091, is Kimberly Plumley, who is a publicist with Publicity Mavens. And you can also find her on thebookbroads.com and garlicandplumjam.com. She's a very, very busy lady, but she took time to do the guest slate, and she also books a lot of guests who sometimes appear on this program, so I thank her for that, and I thank her for doing the slate, and you can check out all those websites that I mentioned because you'll find them on the Stuff File page as well. Thank you very much, Kimberly, for doing the slate on this week's edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, there's nothing wrong with facing your fears head on. Well, except that fear of being naked in public. In Boise, Idaho, police found 20-year-old Jonathan Palmer walking around the north end of town at around 6:30 in the evening, completely nude. Lieutenant Kent Lipple, rhymes with nipple, says dispatchers received several calls from people saying they'd seen him. Turns out Palmer was not under the influence of any drugs or alcohol, but rather told officers he was just out to conquer his own fears about being naked in public and help the public conquer its fears too. He was quoted as saying, "I want the public to understand it's okay to see a man naked walking down the road." At least officers described him as very cooperative and articulate when they arrested him on a misdemeanor public nudity charge. You know, he might have to overcome some new fears if he stays naked in prison. And still with the naked theme, I don't know why you'd want to dance naked in public, much less in the middle of a graveyard, but it happened in Mesa, Arizona, where 25-year-old Kara Mitchell was seen dancing completely nude in a Mesa cemetery. Police said Kara removed her top and danced around for a minute, then dropped her pants and continued spinning around in front of cemetery employees, customers looking for plots, and several groups of visitors who were paying respects to their deceased loved ones. After Kara put her clothes back on, she went to the administrative office, sat down, and started talking to herself. She was found in a cemetery golf cart by the time police arrived and arrested her. No official word, but we're going out on a limb here and suspecting drugs were involved. Now, anybody who's been anywhere near the internet for the last week or so has to be aware that there has been an inordinate amount of fascination with the rear end of Pippa Middleton. That's the sister of Kate Middleton, or as she's known these days, Catherine. Yes, many tasteless videos have made it to YouTube touting the delightfulness of Pippa's bum, as they say in merry old England. But one British wife let her husband know quite firmly that she's having none of it. After the husband made the mistake of expressing his admiration for the Royal Maid of Honor's most talked about asset, his wife took a can of white spray paint to his blue Peugeot 206 and wrote all down the passenger side, "Is Pippa's bum still better than mine?" Question mark, question mark, question mark. Our humbled husband didn't even see it until he was deep in the middle of morning traffic and people kept pointing and laughing at him. A full-color shot of the newly decorated vehicle also made it to the front page of the British newspaper The Sun. Yeah, okay, so she spray-painted, "Is Pippa's bum still better than mine?" I don't know, I'd have to say the answer is, who cares? But she clearly is classier than you, dear. Much classier than you. I'm assuming her husband is not too happy, and maybe that relationship is doomed. Anyway, finally in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest, there are plenty of signs that a person may be too drunk to drive, but 45-year-old Cynthia Salmon of Breckenridge, Colorado, may have added a few new ones to the list. Cynthia was indeed arrested on suspicion of driving under the influence after she was unable to successfully roll down her window or open her car doors. Police pulled her over after they spotted her weaving all over the road. When the officer approached and asked her to roll down the window, she was unable to do it. When he asked her to step out of the car, that too proved to be a task too complex. When the deputy asked her to try unlocking the doors, amazingly, that worked. No surprise, she subsequently failed a voluntary roadside sobriety test. Maybe that's why she declined to take a chemical test, a decision that may be punishable by a year's suspension of her license. Oh, and she couldn't produce her driver's license or proof of insurance either. Wow, that's drunk. Now, what I want to know is if she was that drunk that she couldn't figure out how to open her car door or roll down the window, then how the heck did she start the car in the first place? That takes a little more dexterity than the other two. Anyway, moving right along, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Carla Malden has survived early baby boomer widowhood and has written a book called After Image, a broken-hearted memoir of a charmed life. She is also the daughter of the great Academy Award-winning actor Carl Malden, and she joins us on the line from California. Hi, Carla.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
My pleasure.
You write this book about early widowhood, and I got to think right off the bat that just putting pen to paper or hands to keyboard has got to be somewhat cathartic.
Yes, it is. It was for me. I would say that for me personally, the experience of grief was very fracturing. By that I mean it was kind of a schizophrenic experience, like patting your stomach and rubbing your head at the same time. I would be out to lunch with a friend, but I was really in the business of grieving. Or I would be at the movies, but I was really in the business of grieving, always sort of detached from the moment. And when I sat down to write, I was all in one place, body, mind, and heart. And though that was a horrible and painful place to be, obviously, to be reliving some of this, it was a relief and felt good at least to feel integrated.
Is part of the problem the fact that, because you say you go to lunch with friends or you go to a movie, is part of the problem that people don't understand the grieving process or the fact that it's different for everyone and people don't know how to handle someone who is grieving?
I think that's part of it. I mean, I was very lucky. I had an amazing support system. I was surrounded by wonderful family and friends. But I think it's also something that you do to yourself to think, I should be behaving in such and such a way. And I was very high functioning and looked high functioning, but inside I was obviously flattened. And I think that's part of the reason why I wrote After Image, was that the literature of loss that people were giving me, I found really not particularly helpful. I was not seeing the truth of my personal experience reflected in those. And it's been very gratifying to see that people seem to find themselves reflected in my book, in that it kind of dispenses with the shoulds. There are no benchmarks. After a year, you don't have to have done such and such. You don't have to be, you know, hitting these benchmarks in time. In the grieving process, I think everyone does it differently.
Now, your husband, Lawrence Starkman, had cancer, correct?
Correct.
And it was an 11-month journey from the time, I guess, of his diagnosis till his death?
That's exactly right. He went through the first 6 months. He had surgery. He went through 6 months of chemo, really like the poster child of how you do that, and we thought all was going to be well. And then almost immediately, really immediately, there was a recurrence, and he lived another 3 months.
Does it make things different, the fact that it was something that took a period of time as opposed to something sudden? Does that change the grieving process in any way, shape, or form, in your estimation?
Obviously, I only know my personal experience. I have to guess that it is slightly different, although I say with a certain amount of shame that I was in such denial that I'd never really confronted what was going on, even in that last 3 months. I mean, I just pressed it to the far back of my brain. So we didn't have those talks that I kind of wish we might have had. But I'm sure it is a different process, though I obviously can only speak to mine.
What do you want readers to take away from reading this book?
I would hope that everyone would find something different reflected that might be helpful to them if they're in a grieving process, or in fact, people have told me they've given the book to their family and friends to help those other people in their lives understand their own grieving process. But beyond that, for something universal, I would say a sort of seize the day message. I punctuate the chronology of my story of my husband's illness and then my first year after his death. I punctuate that with what I call snapshots, which are basically little flashbacks to moments in his life that I think define who he was. And that to me was very true to the grieving process. That's what your brain does. You keep flashing back. And I think that clinging to those moments, making those moments fabulous in the moment when the person is alive would be the message that I would hope people would take.
A term that I've seen described in the press material says this is not your mother's widowhood. So what's different about, in your estimation, a modern widowhood as opposed to one of a previous generation?
Well, I think, first of all, a younger widowhood, middle-aged widowhood, is a very different thing. I mean, we were still actively engaged in life. We were at the top of our game. And to sort of all of a sudden have that rug pulled out from under you is a different thing from when you're widowed as an elderly person. And by that I also mean we as baby boomers sort of put our stamp on all different kinds of experiences in a different way. It's kind of we almost feel it our birthright to go through the phases of life in a different way. So we're kind of redefining widowhood, I think. Not so much in the sort of way of reinventing yourself, but just in the fact that I woke up one morning and I was a widow, and it didn't compute. I hadn't even ever felt like a grown-up yet.
I noticed in one of the blurbs written about your book, you got a blurb from Emmy-winning actress Blythe Danner, and she herself was a younger widow.
That's true.
Have you heard from other young widows since you've written the book?
Well, the book is just out, but yes, the manuscript, before it was even published, kind of took on a life of its own, which is what compelled me to try to get it published, in that I gave it to a very small circle of my friends initially who passed it on to other people. And in fact, it was sort of championed by book clubs up and down the coast of California, which I visited. And yes, it got enormous response from widows saying, this is an honest account, an in-the-trenches account of what we've been through and something that they had been looking for. So that was very gratifying to me.
Have you learned something about yourself in writing this book?
I've learned a lot about myself. I am in many ways a better person than I was. By that I mean I don't seem to put limits on myself anymore. I'm not as fearful about a lot of things. I don't care so much what people think about me anymore. I'm a stronger person. I had strength I didn't know I had, which of course is kind of a cliche, but it happens to be the truth.
How long ago did your husband Lawrence die?
A little over 4 years.
And I know people ask the question sometimes, or they say it gets easier. Does it get easier?
It gets different. I would say that you learn that certain things are going to be triggers, and you can go right back into the abyss when you hit these triggers. And other things blindside you. You can't predict what's going to get you. I can be driving in the car and hear a song, and I'm shot for the rest of the day. So I would say that it doesn't get easier. It gets different. You learn to kind of fold the experience of the grief into your everyday life, and to I think I lived a very fulfilling and productive life. I have, once again in my life, more than my share of joy. And I think the person's absence becomes its own kind of presence, ultimately. It's just always there, but you can make it a positive force.
Do you worry about the idea, having written this book, that you might become the poster girl of early widowhood? I think back to when Katie Couric's husband died, and just recently I saw an article. I mean, she's now leaving the CBS Evening News, but that keeps coming up all the time in story after story after story about Katie Couric.
I do worry about that. That's actually a very interesting question. I have given that a lot of thought. And in fact, some people have asked me to blog and so forth, and I don't want to be writing exclusively about that. I'm working on a novel now. I don't want to be that. I don't think it would be healthy for me, and I think I've said really the meat of what I have to say about the subject.
You're working on a novel now, so tell us a little bit about what you are working on.
I'm working on a novel. My husband and I were screenwriting partners, and I have not returned to screenwriting format without him, which is not to say that I never will, but I haven't yet. So I'm working on a novel. It's sort of a coming-of-age story for a woman of a certain age, as they say.
When can we expect to see that?
I don't know. I'm just finishing it. I hope maybe within the year.
Okay. And in the meantime, right now the book that is out is After Image, a broken-hearted memoir of a charmed life. I believe people can check out your website, which is carlamalden.com. What will people find when they go to the website?
They will find quite a bit of material about this book. They will find some material about the autobiography of my father, which I had the great pleasure of writing with him a few years ago. And they'll find out a little bit more about me if they want to.
I should mention that in a previous program that I did back in November of 2004, we had the opportunity to spend a half an hour with your father. It was one of the most enjoyable interviews I ever had a chance to do.
Oh, thank you very much. I was very, very lucky to have him in my life.
You had him personally. We had him on the screen, and we were all very lucky to have him that way as well.
Thank you.
I thank you very, very much, Carla, for taking the time to be on the program to talk with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Carla Malden, author of After Image, a broken-hearted memoir of a charmed life. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0091, and you'll find links to Carla's website and also links to Amazon.com, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Creating a Social Network, and we have another visit from our favorite taxi driver, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, who shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. But right now, more Stuff File news for you. Oh, yes, and of course, we do have an idiot of the day coming up a little later on. But as I said, more Stuff File news coming right here, right now. Looks like somebody won't be getting a Father's Day gift next month. And that somebody is 47-year-old Andy Collins of West Sussex, England. While meeting your boyfriend's parents is usually pretty stressful for young women, for 16-year-old Vicky Collins, it went incredibly well. At the time, Vicky was dating Andy's teenage son, Sean. Now, despite Andy being 23 years her senior, Vicky apparently couldn't fight her attraction for him, and one night after Sean had gone to bed early, she and Andy hooked up. When their continued affair eventually came out, because they announced their engagement, it pretty much blew up the family. Her parents were shocked, too, when they found out Vicky was engaged to a man their own age. They initially refused to sign the permission forms for their under-18-year-old daughter to get married, but as Vicky explains, eventually they agreed when they saw how happy Andy made me. Okay, so jump ahead to today. Vicky is now 24, and while Andy had had a vasectomy, he's had it reversed and they're trying for a baby. And Sean has finally forgiven them and said, "Gradually, Vicky and I started talking again, and now we're pretty good friends. No one thought it would last, including me, but they've been together 8 years, so I suppose it was meant to be all along." Wow, you don't normally hear stories like this coming out of England. The Ozarks, yes, but England, no. Moving right along, here's today's token teacher has sex with her student's story, but at least this one has an interesting Facebook kicker. In Arlington, Tennessee, police arrested 28-year-old Stacy L. Hopkins, a phys ed teacher at Arlington High, and she stands accused of having sex with two minor male students and sending them nude photos of herself via her cell phone. Really? Are you that stupid? Wow. Apparently she is, because on her Facebook page, Ms. Hopkins described her relationship status as complicated, and in describing her job, she wrote, quote, "teaching high school students what not to do or how to do it without getting caught," end quote, ending with a smiley face, I may add. She has confessed to police and probably won't be teaching again for the next 2,000 years. And yet, believe it or not, she's not this week's idiot of the day. That's coming up later. Wait for it. Okay, in Slovakia, a cannibal, yes, I said cannibal, has been arrested after his dinner guest changed his mind and called the police. The would-be victim from Switzerland actually answered an internet ad from the 43-year-old Slovakian cannibal seeking someone who would agree to be, and we're not kidding, killed, cooked, and eaten. The idiot who answered the ad said he thought the offer was nothing more than a macabre fantasy game, but after speaking to the guy on the phone, he realized he was deadly serious. That's when he called Swiss police, who informed their Slovakian counterparts. They, in turn, went in with an undercover officer posing as the victim in a sting operation to catch the suspected flesh eater. Now, during his encounter with police, a gunfight broke out, and both the cannibal and the officer were shot. None of the wounds appear to be life-threatening. In his online advertisement, our friend said he wanted someone who would agree to be put to sleep, then killed, cut up, cooked, and eaten. Well, at least you can't complain about false advertising. Yikes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, in Houston, four people were arrested at a car wash when, in addition to washes and waxes, it seems illegal drugs and raccoon meat. Yes, I said raccoon meat was being sold. Undercover officers said they went inside the full-service car wash and were able to purchase marijuana, prescription drugs, and liquor. So what did owner Michael Maxwell have to say? Well, he told reporters, I don't know why they were here. They don't have a warrant. They came storming into my place. I got all my permits that go with this place. I am licensed with the city. I pay my taxes. This is my property, and it is private. Wow. I don't really have anything to add to that delusional rant. But really, raccoon meat? You know, someone is bound to send me an email to say that it probably tastes like chicken. So I'll nip that one in the bud right now. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? You know, in this day and age, when it comes to doing business, having an online presence is almost essential. But how one navigates that world can be a minefield for some. So on the program with us right now is Angela Crocker, who is the author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Creating a Social Network. Hi, Angela.
Hello.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So you have created this book, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Creating a Social Network. And I should mention you also have a website, which is beachcombercommunications.com that people can check out.
Absolutely.
There are people out there who just don't get it. There are it's like having a website 15 years ago. Some people in business don't know why they should have one. Some people in business don't know what to do with one once they have one. And I think we're in the same place now with social networking.
I would agree completely. I mean, a lot of people, a lot of corporations, small businesses, community organizations have those old school websites that are strictly broadcast. They're one direction. And they're putting out information, content, sharing great things, but there's no mechanism for people to engage with that content and interact and comment. And really, for me, it boils down to the fact that we're now in an era where websites are communities. They're not newspapers. And that mental shift that organizations have to make is essential. And if they're going to survive, their businesses are not going to exist in 5 years if they don't take the time to figure this out now.
Who exactly is the core audience for your book, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Creating a Social Network?
Generally, this book is written for people who want to take on the task of creating a community for their organization. So small to medium-sized businesses, community groups, things like parent advisory councils, soccer teams, those kinds of things can have their own social network. So can special interest groups like knitting clubs or live-action role-play organizations. And then, you know, businesses like mine. I have a Buddy Press community on my website, and people can come and hang out and ask questions about social media if they don't feel like joining me on Facebook or Twitter or somewhere else to find out that information.
Well, that's exactly the question I was about to ask, and that is you mentioned places like Facebook and Twitter, and I want to talk primarily about Facebook here. What's the difference between having your own social network and using one that is existing, as in Facebook?
Well, one of the first things to think about is if you have a social network on your own website, you own that little piece of real estate on the internet, and as a result, you have control over it. Its fate is in your hands. It can continue to exist as long as you think it needs to exist. If you rely exclusively on something like Facebook, you never know what's the latest change. What is Facebook going to shift to a new format? Are you going to be able to contact your people? You know, what if it went away? I'm not saying Facebook's really going anywhere with 600 million or 700 million users, whatever it is now, but you don't have control over it. And so one of the key reasons that people create their own social networks is in order to have that sense of ownership in a really true sense. However, as I advise in the book, you still need to have outposts in other social networks because it's not a kind of community where people are instantly going to join you. You need to be reaching out through other communities. Make it convenient for the users to find you. So my business has a Facebook page at facebook.com/beachcombercommunications. And people can come there, get to know me a little bit, see some of my content, maybe post a question, make a suggestion. And then if they're feeling like they, you know, we're doing the dance, and it's almost like dating. You get to know each other in a really, you know, in the nightclub where there's lots of people around, and then maybe move over into a social network that's hosted by the organization.
Okay, so you're saying that people should have their own social network on their own site. And the first part of the title of your book is The Complete Idiot's Guide, which leads me to ask, how computer savvy does one have to be to do what you're suggesting? Because I'm sure there's some listening right now who are going, uh-oh, I don't know if I'm prepared for that.
Well, there are, as with so many things on the internet, there are different ways to do it, from the very easy to the slightly more complicated but manageable. In the book, I talk about six social network services in particular that take you from the very basic, easy-to-use steps with things like Ning.com and Wall.fm, which are sites that allow you to create your own community on those sites, and they're free or very inexpensive, you know, just a few dollars a year. From there, you can move up to other kinds of services, things like BuddyPress, which is a WordPress plugin. A lot of websites are built on the WordPress content management blogging system now. And BuddyPress is a plugin that allows you to create a community. It's a little bit more complicated, but it has the advantage that you're hosting that community on your own website and not reaching out through a site controlled by someone else like Ning or Wall.fm. Or you can take it a whole other level, which usually involves hiring some consultants or working closely with people at these services. But companies like SocialGo and KickApps, they work with some of the huge brands like Heinz and the Phoenix Suns and, you know, big sports teams and shopping malls to create customized social communities on their websites. And pretty much the anything you might want in a social community is available in all three types. It's just a matter of how much advertising you see, how much branding, how much flexibility that you have in the way it looks. You know, all Ning sites really look very similar. You can generally peg a Ning site just by at a glance after you've seen a few of them. But they're perfectly functional, and it's a place for people to gather. And, you know, it's about the quality of the place that you gather. Does it matter if it's informal? Then don't worry about it. Go with something informal. But if your brand is such that you really want to control every little detail and every period is pink and every cross on the T is purple, then you can do that too if you choose.
Okay, so going back to the first question I asked, back in the day when everyone started jumping on the World Wide Web, people looked at it for their business practices in one way, shape, or form, and there were some people who definitely should have been on the web. And at the time, there were also some people who probably shouldn't have been on the web or didn't need to be. They just felt they had to have a site. Flash forward to today, when it comes to social networking, especially from a business point of view, are there some people who don't need this?
Yes, absolutely. I have the privilege of working with entrepreneurs at Douglas College here in Vancouver, and those entrepreneurs are everything from daycare providers to manufacturing consultants to real estate agents to designers, artists, and other creative types. And not everyone needs a social network on their site or even to use social networking. And certainly anyone who's working with children needs to think very carefully. You know, I always advise the daycare providers not to create too much of a social presence for their business. Certainly privately, personally, they're welcome to do whatever they fancy. But you have to be very careful when you're putting children, anything to do with children, on the Internet. And there are already some safe communities, things like Club Penguin or the Build-A-Bear workshop community that are designed for kids to interact and have fun. And you don't really need to use it as a social network as an advertising vehicle for a community-based daycare. But there are some organizations and some sort of brands, especially people who are heart-centered entrepreneurs or artists, or they're doing something that's dear to their heart, whether they're manufacturing their fabulous patented invention or they're creating original paintings or sculptures that they're promoting and selling. I really encourage people to have a social networking presence in those situations, because getting their voice out, getting their vision out can so easily happen through social networks in a way that's almost impossible in terms of scale. When you look at, you know, going to the local chamber of commerce to speak or doing local art shows or local trade shows, you can only meet so many people one-on-one in a face-to-face situation. But on the Internet, on Facebook, there's millions of people. So the audience is potentially much bigger.
Okay, I have to ask. Looking at your bio, it says that you're an avid finger puppet collector. Since I don't think I've had on this show someone who is an avid finger puppet collector, I have to ask the question, because that seems to be rather unique.
Well, I'm glad you think so. The finger puppet collection is actually an accident. I never sat down and said, I'm going to collect finger puppets. But I've come to realize that my office is filled, well, not filled, but a lot of the surfaces in my office have got things that are current or even vintage. I have some Fisher-Price Sesame Street characters from the 1970s. I have Luke and Leia Star Wars action figures from about 1980. I have lots of soft toys, and they're often mementos or gifts from events and people that I've met or places that I've been, and it's the little thing that's ended up coming home and sticking with me, and all of a sudden I have 30 or 40 sets of eyes looking at me any time I glance around the office. So lots of fun. There's no rhyme or reason to it. It's just whatever catches my eye is the things that get to come home and be part of my collection.
Well, perhaps the next book could be The Complete Idiot's Guide to Finger Puppets, but right now the one we were talking about is The Complete Idiot's Guide to Creating a Social Network. It's written by Angela Crocker, and you can check out Angela's website. And the website, again, is beachcombercommunications.com. And what will people see when they go to the website?
Well, you'll see my smiling face up in the top right-hand corner, and regular content. I blog every week, two or three, four times a week, depending how I'm inspired, on different topics related to social networking, marketing, branding online, branding offline. And I certainly invite anyone listening, if they want to know more, to click into the blue box, the little subscriber box. And each Thursday, I publish a newsletter called the Social Media Minute. Super short, just a quick tip, trick, something that you can apply in your social media efforts right away.
Excellent. I thank you very much, Angela, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Absolutely a delight. Thank you, Peter.
Angela Crocker, author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Creating a Social Network. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0091, and you'll find links to Angela's website, plus also links to Amazon.com, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. It's time again to announce the wackiest warning labels of the year. After reading all the labels submitted to our 14th annual Wacky Warning Label Contest, we've selected the top five, and here are a couple of the most outrageous. Alex Sines of Texas couldn't believe the warning label he found on a common dust mask, the kind you might wear when you're sanding something. It says the mask does not supply oxygen. And Archer Loop of Wisconsin wonders why the cover for his hot tub warns, "Remove safety cover from spa when in use." Now, let's be fair, these warning labels are hilarious, but product makers have to put them there because they're facing so many abusive lawsuits. A few years ago, a tool maker was sued by a man who tried to use one of their wood routers to fix his teeth. So the company put a label on it warning that it's not intended to be used as a dental drill. Unbelievable, but true. To see all the labels, visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we do once indeed have with us Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby from the city that never sleeps, New York City. Hello, sir.
Wake up. Only kidding. It is indeed the city that never sleeps. As a matter of fact, the last time I slept was on Thursday, April 14th, 1942.
Ooh, that's been a while.
Yes, it has.
Since the war.
That's the big war.
Yes. Now, maybe you're tired because you've been having too many egg creams.
Well, first of all, Mr. Weisenheimer, do you even know what an egg cream is?
Yes, I grew up in a very Jewish neighborhood, by the way.
Well, not only is it Jewish, it's really New York. And the deal is this. It was very, very popular in the 40s, the 50s, and then it kind of disappeared. What it is it's a remnant from the days when there used to be soda fountains. Different types of syrup, and you would put the syrup into the bottom of the glass, then you would add some carbonated water, stir vigorously, and you would then have a flavored drink. Well, an egg cream was putting about a half inch of milk at the bottom of the glass, a half inch of chocolate at the bottom of the glass, mixing them a little bit, and then filling the rest with a shot of seltzer, carbonated water, and it, as I say, very, very popular, and it's starting to come back. You know, it goes around, and it's now the kind of thing that is being featured in the few remaining diners that happen to have If they don't have a soda fountain, at least they have the makings for an egg cream. And also, by the way, it's one of New York's oldest gags, because you walk in and you say, well, say to me, make me an egg cream.
Make me an egg cream.
Poof, you're an egg cream. Okay? So there you are, folks. The recipe and the joke. But it is making a comeback.
Or as they said in the album, You Don't Have to Be Jewish, give me an egg cream, please, which was the secret password to secret agent James Bondstein, for those
right, or take my wife, please.
Exactly. Now, what do you think the resurgence of this is due to? Is there something that's
come
up?
It's like movies, and movies get remade. I mean, you know, there's certain kinds of, I think, staples in life. I mean, even I've seen some men wearing pants with cuffs, you know? So, I mean, what goes around comes around, and it's just that they've gone through all the kind of nouvelle cuisines and all the kinds of new foods and all the sushi, bushi, and all that kind of stuff. So somebody said, hey, wait a minute, let's re-look at food of the 40s and 50s.
Now, on to other things. I know that in your business, you live in a world where a lot of your income can be derived from tips. So I'm curious to find out your take on this particular story of one guy who I understand in Brooklyn who was making deliveries was not happy with the tips he was receiving.
Yeah, well, first of all, you nice listeners have to understand the theory behind the tipping in New York City. What you're doing, in a sense, and it's a very old custom, is that you're really paying part of the salary of the person. I mean, in theory, they should get more money from their boss, and that would be the end of it. So you're giving the tip, not so much because of just the service. It's almost like it's obligation mandatory. But I will quickly point out to you that a true New Yorker will not give a tip if he doesn't get or she doesn't get good service. So anyway, you know, how much to tip? In the cab, it's usually rounded off to the next dollar. If the cab ride is $2.20, well, you'd make it $3. If the cab ride was $3.60 or $3.70, then you'd round it off to $5. So that's generally the way it goes in a cab. Then you got doormen and bellhops and all those things. So this guy who delivers things was a little upset that time after time after time he's getting very poor tips. So what he did is he set up a website, and he invites people to write in to him, and give the name, if they possibly have it, of the person who didn't give them a nice tip, and he then puts it on the website, and presumably their lives are destroyed. You know, what can I tell you?
Sounds like a nice guy. Wow.
Yeah, well, he used to be a Navy SEAL.
Well, a lot of people used to be Navy SEALs after last week.
Yeah, I was a Navy SEAL. You can call that New York 1, Al-Qaeda 0. But let me point out to you nice listeners, even though you don't ask me, I'll stick in my 2 cents. All these pictures that the world saw of New Yorkers, forget about the ones in Washington, but New Yorkers yelling and carrying on and dancing in the streets is just the usual CNN garbage. That did not happen. There were a certain number of morons who did that kind of a thing, but most New Yorkers didn't. And I'll tell you something else. Most New Yorkers are a little cynical about the whole event. You know, it sounds awfully like a mob hit. A gang goes in, shoots the guy in the head, and then throws the body into the ocean. It's as if somebody within Al-Qaeda or Pakistan dropped a dime on the guy, and Obama did them the favor of getting rid of the guy. It just doesn't sit right. The story is corny, and I'll tell you something else. Based on my own 30 years of military experience, it just doesn't sound right tonight.
Okay. And on to another big news item that was taking place the week before that, or a few days before that, actually. You didn't go to the royal wedding. I thought for sure you would have been there.
No, but you noticed how Obama waited until the wedding was over until he whacked Osama. That was kind of pleasant of him. I guess he didn't want it to be detracting from his big event. No, I didn't have the opportunity to go, but people were fascinated. People watched it. People got up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, to take a look at it. I think it's harmless. If anything, it's probably very helpful because it puts people in the mood, hey, they want to go to the UK. So there's nothing bad about it. You have a lovely, lovely queen who happens to have a crazy family.
Who doesn't, really?
Right.
Okay, getting back to New York City, there's a story about a waiter at the Waldorf Astoria who had to wear a name tag. His name?
He's a Muslim, an Arab Muslim guy.
Right.
And his name is, I don't know, Muhammad Ali Baba or something or other. And the hotel doesn't want him wearing a name tag that says that, because that, according to him, because that will indicate that he's an Arab, a Muslim. So they make him wear something that says either John, probably John Rabinowitz, or maybe that's just his bad, or Harry Shaughnessy. And he's now filed a lawsuit for something or other against the Waldorf Astoria. And I'm amazed that they let it get into the newspapers, because they should have given the guy a few dollars and let him wear any nameplate he wants.
How does anything, especially with this day and age and the internet, how does anything not get in the newspapers anymore?
Well, that's exactly what happens. And, you know, I'm a strong believer, you know, you settle. In life, you settle. You don't fight or argue with anybody. You come to a deal. Somebody's not going to be happy. Both people aren't going to be happy. You make a deal. Waldorf Astoria should have given them some shekels or whatever those people use, and that would have been the end of it.
Now, this is not something I necessarily would talk about or concern myself with dealing with New York City, but what's the story about concerning laws against bear poaching?
Well, there used to be some laws in New York State and limits about shooting bears and killing bears, and they're pretty lax right now, and it seems, according to the state's hunting and agricultural department, that a lot of Asian people, and see, we just antagonized the Arabs and the Muslims, now let's antagonize the Asians, are killing bears for their parts. Presumably it's some kind of aphrodisiac or what have you. And they're saying now that there should be laws making it very, very stringent and very, very hard, you know, to kill a bear. I mean, you say kill a bear, I'm thinking of the three bears. A mama bear, a papa bear, and a baby bear. And when I used to tell my kids the three bear stories, the way I kind of revved it up is I would give them like a very deep southern accent, like, I do declare someone is eating my porridge. And of course, my kids thought that was riotously funny, and that's probably why they grew up to be racist. No, I'm only kidding.
Okay, and finally, before we let you go, I understand that they're going to or thinking about changing the horn of a New York City taxi. That almost seems sacrilegious.
Oh, the whole thing. It's a bunch of idiots. Ford bid on the new cab. Nissan bid on the new cab. They've awarded the contract of 33,000 new cabs to Nissan, with the big selling point that they can be converted over to electricity, which is absolutely insane. You will not find anybody in New York City who has an electric teapot, an electric water heater, an electric frying pan. Electricity in New York is so unbelievably expensive that just the thought of having an electric cab is enough to drive you off the wall. So I don't know what the deal was. If I was a cynical person, I would say there's something shady about this deal. But I frankly think Ford should have won the contract, and then we would continue to drive the good old gas guzzlers, and that would be the end of it.
But low-intensity horn, custom climate controls for every seat, and power outlets to plug in phones and laptops? Isn't that what you want, Peter?
Peter, you know how long the average New York City cab ride is? Like 11 minutes. I mean, it was just the idea when they put the television things in the back, you know, that you could sit and watch television while you were going someplace in the cab. Everybody turns it off now because it's nonsense. So you don't have enough time in a New York City cab trip to plug your laptop in. You don't need the seat to be warmed because it will have been warmed by the person just before you got in. So it's all rubbish and nonsense. A cab is to take you from point A to point B in about 12 minutes. You don't need any amenities. And above all, as I instruct all the drivers, just keep your mouth shut and drive.
And on that note, I shall give you the opportunity to do the same. But if people want to get in contact with you or check out your website, they can go to www.gabby.com, and they can also email you at peter@gabby.com. And I thank you very much, Peter, for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby from New York City, here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're running at a racetrack with this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming up in just a matter of moments, but a couple of Stuff File news stories I want to get to first off. Prime Minister Vladimir Putin has become the unlikely object of worship for a bizarre all-women Russian cult. Apparently, the ladies believe the tough-talking prime minister is a reincarnation of the early Christian missionary, the Apostle Paul. Members of the cult that has sprung up in a Russian village 250 miles southeast of Moscow believe the 58-year-old politician is on a mission from God. The cult's leader or founder calls herself Mother Fatina and says, according to the Bible, Paul the Apostle was a military commander at first and an evil persecutor of Christians before he started spreading the Christian gospel. In his days in the KGB, Putin also did some rather unrighteous things, but once he became president, he was imbibed with the Holy Spirit, and just like the apostle, he started wisely leading his flock. It is hard for him now, but he is fulfilling his heroic deed as an apostle. Followers are reportedly encouraged to sing upbeat patriotic Soviet songs and are said to survive on a Spartan diet of turnips, carrots, peas, and buckwheat. Well, at least not eating any raccoon meat. And even the police in Sonoma, California admit they're baffled by this one. A 53-year-old man told police he was in his apartment when a woman appeared in his doorway and told him that she was there to give him an enema. Because the man had recently undergone intestinal surgery, he thought that sounded possible. So our gal guided him to his bedroom, had him drop his pants and lie face down on the bed. She then gave the man an enema and promptly left. But after a few days to reflect on the incident, it occurred to the guy that the woman did not leave a card or any other identifying information. So he grew suspicious and contacted police. An investigating officer promptly called the man's doctor and was told no enema had been prescribed. Sonoma police turned the case over to the Domestic and Sexual Assault Unit of the Sonoma Sheriff's Office, who have yet to make any sense out of any of this at all. Well, that would make him the butt of a lot of jokes, wouldn't it? Anyway, let's get to our final story of the day. That, of course, would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Love makes us do some pretty dumb things, doesn't it? But the dumb things love makes people do also help bring Denver's ho-hum bandit to justice after a string of 24 bank robberies and 2 years on the run. The end came when Adam Lynch was desperate to get back with his girlfriend. To prove his love to her, he told her he wanted to come clean with her and confessed his crimes. He even showed her the FBI website on his cell phone so that she could see his picture and that he was indeed wanted for bank robbery. This proved to be a very bad idea as she immediately called the FBI and turned him in. The girlfriend, Julia Lundstrom, told police she had had enough of his lies. So Lynch was arrested and charged with robbing 10 banks in Colorado, 12 in California, 1 in Wyoming, and 1 in Washington State, although he's pleaded not guilty to all charges. He's looking at up to 20 years in prison, by the way, if convicted. The FBI dubbed Lynch the ho-hum bandit because on surveillance footage, he often appeared bored and sometimes yawned during his robberies. Amazingly, Lynch did not have any prior criminal record, and his brother is in law enforcement. Now, why would a guy who has successfully eluded police for 2 years after a series of bank robberies tell his girlfriend about his crimes to win her love? Wow, one reason and one reason only. He's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0091. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page for this show. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0091. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.